The Guardian.
At the end of July, a group of 100 Tory MPs relaunched the One Nation group, in part hoping to reel Boris Johnson back from the hard right of his party and lure him towards the centre. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and throughout August, I'm speaking to some of the UK's most prominent political movers and shakers. This week, I talked to the former de facto Deputy Prime Minister under Theresa May and the chair of the One Nation group, Damian Green, about whether or not the Prime Minister is truly a One Nation Conservative and about his plan to move the Conservative story beyond Brexit. This is Politics Weekly. So Damian Green, you're often associated with a kind of Tory, a sort of wing of the Conservative Party, and people think about that wing as looking, if not forlorn, then even perhaps extinct at the moment after so many people who one would think of as allies for you were booted out of the Conservative Party ahead of the December 2019 election over Brexit and other things. Do you think the Damian Green form of Toryism is extinct?
Well, no, I don't think there's a Damian Green form of Toryism. There is a One Nation form of Toryism, which it's a way of thinking about the world, which is moderate, compassionate, but conservative as well. It's not, I mean, one of my least favourite words in politics is centrist, because that just means your political ideas are defined by other people. I think there is a clear One Nation conservative tradition, which stretches, you know, from Disraeli through people like Baldwin and Harold Macmillan and Rab Butler, and then on through people like Peter Walker, and on through modern conservatives through David Cameron, and up to, and most notably, including Boris Johnson, who wastes no opportunity to describe himself as a One Nation conservative, and certainly was when he was Mayor of London. So what the One Nation caucus, which I now lead in Parliament, attempts to do is to encourage the Prime Minister into a route I think he wants to go down anyway. And to take head on the point about, is this type of conservatism extinct? Absolutely not, in that I'm delighted to say that we started the One Nation caucus in the new Parliament after the election last December, and have now got more than 100 members, of whom a really significant proportion are active members. And we're in the middle of producing a series of policy papers this summer to try and lay the groundwork for the right type of recovery from COVID.
Well, you see, in your account there of the Prime Minister, you mentioned that he was certainly a One Nation Conservative when he was Mayor of London. You say that he wastes no opportunity to use the phrase, the language of One Nation, but what was missing there in that account was actually being a One Nation Conservative as Prime Minister. I mean, do you think in the job he is honouring the principles of One Nation Conservatism?
Yes, he is. I think the problem, if I can go straight to the difficult point, is obviously Brexit, in that over the past 15, 20 years or so, One Nation Conservatives have been, on the whole, the strongest advocates of Britain remaining in the European Union. We lost that argument in 2016. And the view of the modern One Nation caucus is that we accept the result and we now need to get on with life and make the best of it and make sure that the domestic policies of the UK government accord with One Nation conservative principles. And in that, I do think Boris has been true to his One Nation traditions. I think he's getting more criticism from, if you like, the more traditional right of the party, who think that because he supported Brexit, that he should agree with them on everything else as well. And he clearly doesn't, in terms of economic policy, of the use of the power of the state to spread wealth and opportunity, both geographically and socially, both of which would be at the absolute heart of any One Nation Conservative policy, but maybe couldn't be described as a sort of orthodox Thatcherite policy. So I think Boris is on the right track.
I suppose the phrase, and this is partly its strength, the phrase One Nation, it's so big and sort of capacious that it can mean all different things to different people. On this point, I suppose the Michael Heseltine economic interventionism bit of One Nationism, yep, Boris Johnson and his government have that covered. But yes, as you signaled, the pro-Europeanism, well, that's certainly not part of Boris Johnson conservative vision. And is that, it was really that Brexit piece that I had in mind in terms of when I used that word forlorn. And I'm just thinking, actually, in some ways, on a human level, just so many of your allies, people who you would have seen as colleagues, from Dominic Grieve through to Nicholas Soames through to Amber Rudd, these people are no longer there in the House of Commons, and 21 of them were purged. I mean, they were kicked out for being pro-European, in effect.
Well, yes. I mean, it was a tough and difficult period. Some of those 21 were, of course, let back in and are still colleagues of mine. But yes, I regret the fact I don't have, Amber and people like that, Nick Soames, alongside me in Parliament anymore. But life goes on. And even if the people change, the verities are eternal. And the trick is to find new people, new generations to pick up the torch and carry on. And that's what we're doing.
Let's just talk a little bit about where you come from politically, and just because I think for a lot of people who don't follow politics hugely closely, in a way you sort of popped up at a very high level under Theresa May, suddenly being described as de facto deputy prime minister, even for people who hadn't sort of followed the career before then. What interests me a lot is your move from the job I do, from journalism, where you were in the 70s and 80s, you worked for as a business journalist for the BBC and for Channel 4 News and then The Times, and then made the shift out of journalism to work with John Major in his policy unit in the 90s. Well, actually, yeah, in the 90s. Just that move, and we know it's one that the Prime Minister himself made from journalism to politics. Michael Gove did the same. I'm always fascinated, for obvious reasons, given that I'm a journalist. What happens in the mind of a journalist to say, I don't just want to be on the sidelines commentating, I want to be on the pitch? Was that, broadly speaking, the thinking? And if so, explain it to me.
Funnily enough, that is exactly the analogy I always use when people ask me this question. That's it. In the end, it's better to be a player than a spectator and commentator. And it became apparent to me. I wasn't one of those who had a sort of envelope written down at the age of 18 with all the stages plotted of ascent. I think, and partly because of the way journalism has changed since I was doing it, television journalism, which I did mostly, was huge fun in the 80s and also relatively more important than it is now because of social media. But most of all, it was a better place to work. It seems to me that, as it were, my would-be colleagues, if I'd stayed there, and now with 24-hour news and social media and everything like that, journalism has changed to become much more of a sausage factory than it was when I was doing it in the 1980s. So that's less fun. But in the end, it's the importance of politics that if you think it's very important in the lives of millions of people, which it clearly is, and you think you've got something to offer, then go for it. And that's what I did. And indeed, as you say, quite a lot of other senior members of the current cabinet did it, not just Boris himself, but Michael Gove as well, of course.
That's right. I mean, it is a move that people do make, and it's a fascinating one. I mean, just on that, about that judgment that it's better to be a player than a spectator, given everything that's happened, is that still your judgment, do you think?
Well, that's another good question, because it's one of those things that you do think, what advice would you give your 30-year-old self? And frankly, there have been times when I wonder whether, although I would have felt I was slightly on the sidelines, I think it's undoubtedly true that I would have had a more comfortable life and probably a more lucrative career and fewer pressures if I'd stayed in journalism and made a go of that. I would still advise people who, as it were, have the political bug in their 20s and 30s to do it for two reasons. One is because I suspect they'd never forgive themselves if they didn't. And more importantly, because if people start thinking all the pressures on modern politics and the personal sacrifices and all of that are so bad that I'm not prepared to put up with them, then we will end up with worse politicians than we have now. And I know throughout history, people have held a low opinion of politicians. But that doesn't mean that politics couldn't get worse if you actually discourage talented and enthusiastic people from whatever their views are and whatever their background is from getting involved.
Let's just talk a bit about how your sort of career did take off once you had made that move. It interests me that you worked a bit for John Major, and then your rise to great prominence came really working in the Home Office under Theresa May, because she then propelled you when she took over as Prime Minister. And she was sort of seen, I think, as a great patron of yours. And just whether there's something in these two figures, John Major, Theresa May, have in common that made you a very natural ally for both of them.
Not particularly, to be perfectly honest. I joined John Major's policy unit mostly through one of my sort of mentors in my journalistic career was Sarah Hogg. So I didn't know John Major all that well. I'd done the odd bit of writing for him before then. So I don't think there's any particular connection other than the fact that John Major, I think, surprised people when he became Prime Minister that he was squarely in the One Nation tradition. It was obviously great to work with him. But the link with Theresa was indeed at the Home Office. A lot is made of the fact that we'd known each other from when we were both at university together. But actually, the more important link was the fact that I'd been one of her ministers at the Home Office for 4 years, and we established a good working relationship there. And Theresa's a pretty unsentimental human being, and she wouldn't have appointed anyone out of sort of non-professional reasons. And she, as I say, she and I had worked together well at the Home Office.
Just one thing about that period in the Home Office. That was the period of the so-called hostile environment. There'll be plenty of Guardian readers, Guardian listeners who link hostile environment with the Windrush scandal. Does it now discomfort you, even shame you, that the hostile environment happened in the Home Office when you were there, and indeed you were Immigration Minister in that Home Office?
Well, indeed I was. In fact, the phrase "the hostile environment" was created by the previous Labour government. It wasn't a new invention, and what it was meant to be was a hostile environment for illegal, for people living here who had no right to be here, and it involved cracking down on bank accounts if people had no right to be here. So I don't feel ashamed of it, partly because it was a continuation of a policy, and also partly because it wasn't when I was Immigration Minister. It wasn't the time of those wretched vans that drove around, which I did think that was after I left government, and I did think that was a mistake.
These were the vans that said "Go home" on the side and went round areas where it was thought to be there were some illegal immigrants, but it often was areas where there were regular immigrants and indeed ethnic minorities.
Yes, I mean, and that was clearly wrong. And when the Windrush inquiry was taking place, obviously I was asked questions about my time as Immigration Minister, and answered, as I will answer publicly, that it wasn't an issue. I don't remember any cases, and nobody's found any Windrush type cases that came up in front of me. So it's always been a puzzle to me why suddenly this came up later. We clearly weren't behaving. We weren't trying to remove people who'd been here for decades when I was at the Home Office. So I'm genuinely, as I say, slightly puzzled as to why that started happening.
Taking all that on board, does it shame you just as a Conservative that the Windrush scandal happened on the Conservatives' watch?
Well, with Windrush, as I say, deporting people who'd been here for decades was a terrible, wrong thing to do. And wrong things happen inside government. I think it's important to take responsibility for your own personal actions as a minister. And I would always do that. And as I say, it wasn't an issue when I was a minister.
After the break, I'll talk to Damien Green about whether Theresa May would have been better suited than Boris Johnson to handle a national pandemic, and if the Tories have lost forever a reputation they once cherished as the party of competence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this week I'm speaking with the Conservative MP, Damien Green. When Theresa May was Prime Minister, the focus of all her energies was getting a Brexit deal. Do you now look at Boris Johnson's Brexit deal and think, you know, or perhaps privately to yourself, that is just a worse version of the deal Theresa May got and that she couldn't get past? And how on earth, in a way, has he got all this credit for this big breakthrough when all he's done is take her deal and actually just compromise on a bit she hadn't compromised on, namely the border down the Irish Sea? You'd have every right to feel a little bit, as a supporter of Theresa May's, a little bit aggrieved by that, wouldn't you?
I mean, counterfactual history is always fascinating, but it's not very worthwhile speculating. I mean, I agree that the deals are, for obvious reasons, pretty similar, because we have Boris built on what Theresa had done, and as you say, compromised in areas where she didn't, but got a deal. You know, I am more than happy to put aside any musings along the lines you've put to me. In return for actually getting a withdrawal agreement, we have got a withdrawal agreement. We're now going through the same thing again with the negotiations over the trade deal. And just as I wish the government well in getting a withdrawal agreement, I wish them well in getting a trade deal as well, because I've argued consistently all the way through that, you know, the people having spoken and we have got to leave, but, you know, let's leave on as good terms as possible, both economically and, you know, almost more importantly, psychologically. You know, that in the end, the 27 countries of the EU are friends, neighbours, democracies, people, you know, they're our single biggest trading partner. So let's stay on good terms with them. The world is a dangerous place. We need to be looking for friends and not new enemies.
I mean, you say absolutely rightly that we're back doing all this again, and there's discussion now about whether we will get a trade deal and whether there's enough time, or whether we're going to leave on New Year's Eve of this year with no deal. Will you and your 100 members of your One Nation group, you know, suit up and saddle up again for battle if there seems to be a very strong likelihood of a no deal exit? Will we see a rerun of people who had previously been, you know, Remainers fighting for us to not leave with no deal?
No, I think there is no appetite. I have no appetite for a rerun of the events inside the Conservative Party in 2019. And also the One Nation caucus now includes people who voted for Brexit. I'm trying to move the debate on from where the sort of equation of being a One Nation Conservative means you have to have this particular view about the European Union. And in any case, the whole dynamics are different. A government with a big majority is not in the same place as a government in a hung parliament. So I think, I mean, I will and do continue to argue the case that leaving with a deal is much better than leaving with no deal. And I am not as pessimistic as some commentators are about the progress of these talks.
What is your forecast for the impact Brexit will have on this country and particularly, I suppose, its economy?
It's a perfectly good question to which my entirely honest answer is I don't know. I mean, all expectations are that the economy is in for a rough couple of years because of COVID. How you will be able to judge what the effect of Brexit is within that rough period, I genuinely don't know. And I think all economic forecasting is going to be, or indeed economic analysis, is going to be particularly difficult over the next couple of years. And a lot will depend on how fast and how good the various trade deals are. I mean, not just the deal I hope we sign with the EU, but with other countries as well, because if we can position ourselves as a global player and champion of free trade, then the world will look slightly more rosy than it does otherwise. So essentially, it's all still to play for.
We mentioned that you were for a long time seen at Theresa May's right hand. You were always described as the de facto deputy prime minister because of this role you had as first secretary of state. But you actually had it only for about 6 months, for half a year. I'm just thinking, when you look back at the long sweep of your career, does it pain you that you were only in such a role for such a short time?
Yes, of course. I mean, I would prefer to carry on, though I'm realistic enough to think that the sort of period 2018-2019 wasn't a very happy period for the country or the Conservative government of it. So I don't suppose if I'd, as it were, carried on until the end of that parliament doing that role, or rather the end of Theresa's prime ministership, that it would have been a particularly happy period. And, you know, the obvious question is, you know, could I have made a difference? You know, it's conceivable that the sort of dynamics within the party could have been different, and we might have been able to get a deal through. But what I think one of the sensible rules in life to avoid going mad is not to speculate on what might have been and what could have happened. Counterfactual history, as I've said, is always fascinating. But sitting down and thinking, you know, it could all have been different, is not very good for anyone. So, you know, crack on and get on with your life.
Now, as people will know, you left that post after being accused of behaving inappropriately towards a young woman journalist. Looking back on it now, do you think it was fair that you were removed from that post?
I've taken a vow of silence on that. I've sort of said what I said at the time, and I don't think speaking retrospectively at this distance is of any use to anyone. So I will maintain my vow of silence on everything that happened around that.
And then just to move beyond your own personal case, I mean, that was all part of this sort of Me Too movement. And I just wonder, beyond your own case, whether you feel in general the Me Too movement went too far.
Well, no, I think I mean, one of the points I would make is that I have every sympathy with those who feel that Parliament was a toxic place to work. I have heard tales of terrible behaviour. And yeah, it needs to stop, and it should never have happened. And there's now a much better system with an independent complaint system. That's a step forward.
And we, as you and I speak, and he's not yet been named, a Conservative Member of Parliament, former minister, has been arrested in this connection. And yet the story's been told that he, as it stands, there won't be a suspension of the whip from him. Do you think that's the right way to approach this?
Well, I think, just as a general point, regardless of who's involved or indeed what professional job the person involved is, I think the idea that, you know, one should say nothing or do nothing in public that might interfere with the course of a criminal investigation is a good one. And so, for obvious reasons, I think the first thing that needs to happen in any situation is that the police investigation needs to be completed. You know, if the police are involved, then nothing should be done to interfere with their investigation.
But while that's ongoing, should he, as Labour have been saying, have the whip withdrawn?
Well, that's the point, that if you do that, then that could conceivably compromise a police investigation. So I imagine that. I mean, I don't know, but I imagine that's why that's not been done.
I'm not sure how I could understand how it might, sway a jury, but why would it compromise a police investigation?
Well, I mean, neither you nor I know the details of what the police investigation is into. All I suspect we've both seen is what's appeared in public. So I don't know, but I think, as a rule, erring on the side of not interfering with a police investigation is probably a good one for everyone to observe.
Now, we talked about you as being the right-hand man for Theresa May for a long time. She, like you, is still in the House of Commons. How often do you speak to her? And particularly, I'm interested how she feels now, because we don't hear much from her directly. We saw her get extremely tearful the day she announced that she was standing down as Prime Minister. I'm just, you know, because you're close to what you can tell us about how she sees things now. And as I say, how often you speak to her?
I do speak to her, obviously, because we have offices in the same building. So we see each other around the place as much as is possible in the slightly odd way that Parliament is operating at the moment, when, you know, there are fewer people around than there normally are. And she is doing what you would expect. She is getting on with her life. And clearly, it was an incredibly difficult period for her at the time she was basically forced out as Prime Minister. But she has dusted herself down. And, you know, I observe that in the last couple of weeks, she's produced her own 10-minute rule bill and is continuing with the work as a diligent backbench MP. We've developed a tradition of Prime Minister stopping being Prime Minister and just leaving straight away. Tony Blair did, David Cameron did. So I think it's hugely to her credit that you know, she wants to stay in the House of Commons because, and you know, it was her choice. She had several months after she'd stopped being Prime Minister. She needn't have run in the 2019 general election. She didn't want to, but she did want to because she regards the House of Commons as important, and you know, she knows how to pull the levers, and she's obviously doing so. So, you know, to say she's doing what you'd expect of Theresa. She is getting on with the job.
It is absolutely as you'd expect. I mean, no one ever faulted her industry. Again, on a human level, I have to say, I find it amazing that she can go back in there and look in the eye these colleagues who, as you said, forced her out, politically speaking, did sort of undo her, and then she has to sort of see them in the corridor and nod across the tea room. That's quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, she's a hugely controlled human being. She has her inner thoughts and feelings, but she won't let that interfere with what she sees as, you know, the necessary job to do, and that's what she's doing. And you know, I think that's wholly admirable.
Now, you steered us away from counterfactual thinking, but I do often wonder, and I'd just love to hear what you think about this, whether the country and the Conservative Party got this the wrong way round and really should have had Boris Johnson to get the Brexit deal and then have Theresa May in charge to deal with a national pandemic, because of her experience as Home Secretary, etc. She might have been really well suited for that, and Boris Johnson well suited to getting Brexit through and winning an election. Do you think, in a way, quirk of history, but this was the wrong way around?
I've heard that thought, that yes, that everything has happened in the wrong order. I think when we look back on the long sweep of this, regardless of the personalities involved, there is a case to make that after the explosion and of shock at the way the Brexit vote went, that the new Prime Minister should have been somebody who had supported Brexit. That, I suspect, will be history's verdict.
Oh, that it was a mistake in the summer of 2016 to not have a Brexiter as PM.
Yeah, that would have been the natural order of things when you look back. Quite a lot of prime ministers come to power at a time where they might have regretted. It's been observed about David Cameron that, you know, he was a great politician for good times. He could cheer people up. He was optimistic. He had visions of society that a lot of people bought into. And yet he came to power immediately after the 2008 financial crash. So had to run a government in a certain way where huge financial constraints were the main driving factor behind it, which he would have, you know, so for his entire period as prime minister, the world was not as he would have wished it to be. Oddly, the only prime minister who inherited exactly what he would have wanted was Tony Blair, who, although he inherited from another party, you know, the economy was going perfectly well in 1997. And so Tony Blair could do what he wanted to do in his first few years as prime minister. And that's a luxury given to very few prime ministers.
Yeah, he was a lucky general, Tony Blair. I think we can agree on that. But just beyond the question of who's in number 10, the rest of the cabinet, it does seem pretty mad that there is no room in a Conservative cabinet for the likes of, he's now on his way to the Lords, for Philip Hammond, but Dominic Grieve, yourself, Sajid Javid, Jeremy Hunt, and yet there is room at the highest level for the likes of Priti Patel and Dominic Raab. Plenty of Conservatives do say this is a pretty low calibre cabinet, don't you think?
No, I don't. A lot of these people are friends of mine, and the fact that I disagreed with them about Brexit doesn't mean they stop being friends of mine. I've worked very closely with Dominic Raab over time, and it's my slightly mournful observation that the politicians in power are always regarded as not as good as either previous generations of politicians or future generations. You can have been completely reviled when you're in office, but as soon as you're not in office, you become a sort of statesman. I look forward confidently in 20 years' time to have people mourning that, why don't we have great politicians like we had yesterday, probably quoting members of the current cabinet who at the moment commentators are happily reviling.
You mean we'll be saying, why do we not have a Home Secretary like Priti Patel?
Exactly.
And why do we not have a Foreign Secretary like Dominic Raab? Okay, well, maybe we'll put a small wager on that. Last thing, Damian Green, which is the government and its record on the pandemic, and whether one thing that even people who faulted the Conservatives for ideologically over the years, they did give credit to the Conservatives for having a basic level of competence. Does it trouble you or worry you that the Tories might lose that for their handling of coronavirus? England, in the most detailed and recent study, the number one country for excess deaths in Europe, the lockdown coming by common consensus too late and perhaps losing thousands of lives in the process, and now advice that people just cannot make head or tail of. You know, you are meant to work, but you're not. You're meant to be in the pub, but you're not, etc. Is this going to dent what has been an enduring asset for the Conservative Party, which is a reputation for basic competence?
I don't think so, because there's a danger that sort of political commentary is either black or white. You know, either everything is world class, or you know, this is all a complete shambles. And actually, I'm sort of with the British people on this, who what one can see from the surveys and polls and so on, have made the sensible and pragmatic decision that, you know what, this is a huge crisis. Nobody saw it coming. Some things have gone well. Some things have gone badly. But on the whole, people are doing their best. And, you know, it's a mixture of good and bad. And so let's not get overexcited about it. I think that there is a sort of danger. It's a particularly true, obviously, because of social media, of modern political commentary, that, you know, unless something is either the best in the world or the worst in the world, it's not making a story. And as I say, the truth dispassionately from the outside is that, you know, mistakes have been made, but a lot of things have gone extraordinarily well. I'm not going to say that, you know, Britain's reaction has been absolutely brilliant all the way through, but nor do I subscribe to the sort of catastrophe theory.
Damian Green, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Next week, in the last of this series of interviews, I'll be talking to the Finance Secretary in Scotland, Kate Forbes, about what it was like to face a pandemic so soon after taking office, and what she sees as the future for Scottish politics and Scottish independence.
The longer Boris Johnson says no, the more persuaded others will be. And I think that eventually becomes such a wall of support that Scotland will become independent.
But that's all from me this week. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please stay safe and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.